dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. Few people have chronicled important moments in that war, and indeed policies that have made it come out rather better than worse, is our first guest. She is Dr. Kyron Skinner. She is a research fellow at the esteemed Hoover Institution and also the founding director of the Center for International Relations and Politics at Carnegie Mellon University. She is the author of numerous books, including many detailing Ronald Reagan's thoughts and policy directions. Her most recent one is Turning Points in Ending the Cold War. Kyron Skinner, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank, for inviting me, and this is such a sober time, so we've got a lot to talk about.
We do, and not too much time to do it in, so let me get right to it. You have been giving serious thought, of course, to ending wars, notably, as I say, your book about the Cold War. President Obama would have us believe that in the 21st century, there's a new way to end wars, the way he's been doing it. How's that working out, Kyron? And what are the historical prospects for it actually proving successful?
The 21st century American way of war is incredibly dangerous. It's inconsistent with American history. It's inconsistent with how great powers have behaved. And it's inconsistent with the fact that the United States is the world's only remaining superpower and is responsible for organizing the international system. We're nearly 50% of world defense spending. We make international organizations work insofar as they can. International norms around peace and democracy don't stand a chance without the United States providing an organizing force. But we have in the 21st century, coming out of the White House, there's a view that we can retreat, that we can end wars by walking away from them, just simply withdrawing. Whether hostilities have stopped or not. And we're seeing the dangerous effects of this in Iraq, and we're seeing the potential danger in Afghanistan because we're going to repeat the pattern in 2016. At the same time, we see the danger of not even entering a conflict. I'm talking about Syria as well. We have helped unleash al-Qaeda and its affiliates and great terror across the broader Middle East, simply because we believe that withdrawing is the only strategy available to the United States.
One other facet of this, it seems to me, Kyron, is that the president has had this conceit about how not only to end wars, but the nature of the enemy that we're fighting in these wars, and that somehow by defining down that enemy to exclude most of the Islamists who share al-Qaeda's ambitions, and focusing really almost exclusively on core al-Qaeda, as they've called it, the Obama administration will somehow be able to, you know, end the war with al-Qaeda as well. This really begets, it seems to me, and I think what you've written about most recently at the New York Times on the 15th of June is an fatuous nonsense that is going to expose not only our interests and allies in the Middle East to grave perils, as you say, this Islamist sort of enterprise expands inexorably and increasingly rapidly. But in other places of the world that you've spent a lot of time focusing on, notably Russia and its so-called near abroad and China's ambitions in the Western Pacific, talk a little bit about sort of this environment. Are we looking at what Winston Churchill once called sort of the gathering storm beginning to emerge again, a new threat to world peace?
I absolutely believe so. And if I can go back to what you were just talking about at the beginning of your discussion here, I've said this in numerous interviews, maybe even on your station. We are in a period of kind of rhetorical confusion about the nature of the threat. We are unwilling in Washington, especially in the White House, to talk about radical Islam, about Islamists. We call them extremists, and militants. But we don't talk about the fact that this is a band of people who are not mainline Muslims in any way, but they are Islamists who seek to destroy our way of life, who reject Western values, who embrace terror and militarism as a way to achieve their objectives, and who are seeking to establish a caliphate across Syria and Iraq, a new state that would be the hotbed of terrorism. As someone said recently in one of the many interviews that have been going on about this conflict in the last month, what makes this so particularly dangerous, what ISIS is doing, as the organization is known, in Iraq, in Syria, that's been fomenting the crisis that we've seen in the last few weeks. What they've been doing is attempting to establish a new state, a home base for terrorists, many of whom have been dispersed in the broader Middle East. Now they would have a place to convene. This is particularly dangerous. And we have a White House that does not understand that we are in a conflict with radical Islam, that jihadists are the ones that are prepared to develop a new state and kill Americans, our allies in the Middle East, direct their venom at the Israelis. And so until we can get the rhetorical part straight, there's no way of having a public policy that will allow us to match what the jihadists are actually doing.
Let me just round it out, though, Karen Skinner, because it seems to me that what we're dealing with here is even bigger than ISIS, even bigger than its prospective caliphate in parts of Syria and Iraq and maybe Jordan next. We're, of course, looking at other jihadists who share their ambition. They may have differences about their organizational structure or, for that matter, even some fine points of Islam. But Iran, you know, and the Shiites and Hezbollah have their similar aspirations of global domination. And I think this was really getting to the heart of your point. We're not just looking at trouble in a distant part of the world. We're looking at people who have, that they believe, God-directed mandate to bring that trouble here to us at home as well, right?
And so I've called it distorted Islam or distorted jihad. And you're right, it's not just ISIS in Iraq and Syria. It's the Iranian regime. It's Hezbollah in Lebanon. And they're all united in a way, even though they have some core differences, but they're united in another core way, in that they direct their venom against the United States, and we are at the center of what, and the West, at what they want to see done away with. And we don't have a strategy that helps us understand how to deal with these different threats that are somehow connected to each other, because we don't believe that they are a fundamental threat in the first place. And that's the core problem. The president said in his West Point speech, and I'm sure you did programming on it and read it very carefully, that we have core interest and that we're prepared to go it alone, to act unilaterally on those core interests. But he did not go on to define what those core interests are. And that's the problem. We don't know what the core interests are for this administration.
Karen, we're almost out of time, and I just want to stitch this together. You've written magnificently over many years about Ronald Reagan. Your book, Reagan in His Own Voice, Reagan, A Life in Letters, Reagan in His Own Hand, among them. Talk a little bit about how this whole attitude, posture, doctrine, policy contrasts with Ronald Reagan pithily described it as peace through strength. And if he were with us today, what do you think he would be making of what we're in?
I think he'd be deeply disturbed to watch the unraveling of the United States as a great power. And that's what actually is, this is all about, whether we want to be a great power or not. And I think that's what the administration is struggling with, that it's uncomfortable with the whole notion of leading the world, when there's no other country on earth that could possibly do it. The Chinese can't do it, and the Russians can't do it. But Reagan, in his view, I think, would be dismayed, because, you know, at the core of the Reagan Doctrine was rolling back the adversary's influence anywhere and everywhere across the world, and it actually worked. By the time Reagan left office, apartheid was unraveling in southern Africa. He fixed the Namibia issue, which was the pathway to South Africa. The Soviets were running out of Afghanistan. They'd given up in Angola. They'd given up in Central America. Reagan went on a full court assault against the adversary, and he felt that was the only way to ensure peace.
We win, they lose, as he says. Kyron, we have to leave it at that. My friend, thank you very much for joining us, as well as all the other work that you do at the Carnegie Mellon Center you run and also at the Hoover Institution. Your books are required reading for us all, as are your various contributions to the periodical literature as well. Keep it up. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Ambassador Eric Edelman joins us. We'll get his take on this Iraq story and Turkey as well.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
On August 2nd, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors,
dedicated to supporting the troops and their families.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families. Retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
Hello, I'm Gary Sinise. It's been 20 years since Forrest Gump, and the story of Lieutenant Dan's triumphant return to normalcy is still a part of my life. I'm honored to share it with the real-life Lieutenant Dan's living among us, the more than 1,700 battle-injured amputees that have returned home since 9/11. As citizens, it's our duty to ensure these heroes get the care they need. Join the Gary Sinise Foundation and help support America's wounded heroes. Visit GarySiniseFoundation.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of the men I've come to admire greatly in his time in government service, is Ambassador Eric Edelman. He formerly served in a number of capacities in our government, including as an Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under George W. Bush. He is also a retired career minister from the U.S. Foreign Service, with, among other posts in his background, he was the ambassador to Finland and of particular relevance to our conversation today, to Turkey. Ambassador Edelman, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Good to be with you, Frank.
I'm very keen to get your thoughts. We've just been talking with Kyron Skinner of kind of the big picture on this prospect that we can end wars just by walking away from them and what it's left us in Iraq. What's your current reading, Ambassador Edelman, on the situation in Iraq and our choices there for what to do about it?
Well, first, Frank, to answer the question whether you can walk away from wars by declaring that you've ended them, I mean, obviously the answer to that is no, that's not how it works. As my former colleagues in the Pentagon like to say, the enemy gets a vote. And in this instance, what President Obama has actually done is, as former Vice President Cheney suggested in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal the other day, is snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. When we departed at the end of the Bush administration, the insurgency had largely been defeated. Levels of violence in Iraq at the time we turned over the keys to the Obama administration in January 2009 were down below the levels before we went in 2003. And the administration, and really it was the president, because he was opposed in this by Secretaries Gates, Secretary Panetta, and apparently, according to her account, Secretary Clinton. The president ultimately decided on a set of conditions that made it impossible to negotiate a residual force in Iraq, and what we're seeing today is the consequences of that. A very bad decision, in my view.
Yeah, and we're likely to see a lot more consequences. We're visiting with Ambassador Eric Edelman, a man who has served his country in a number of senior capacities, including as our ambassador to Turkey. And, Mr. Ambassador, one of the things that I'm struck by as we watch what's happening in Iraq is that one of the few seemingly positive upshots is that the people in the Kurdish areas of Iraq may become more independent of this government. You've expressed concern about what a truly independent Kurdistan might represent for those people most immediately, of course, and for others in the region. Talk a little bit about your sense of that.
Well, it's actually quite interesting. You know, you've mentioned that I served as U.S. ambassador to Turkey. When I was there, I was told in no uncertain terms by the Turkish general staff that were the Kurdish Peshmerga to seize the city of Kirkuk and the oil facilities in the environs of the city, that would be a casus belli for Turkey. It was a red line. And when it actually happened in the event last week, actually there were sighs of relief from Turkey, which just gives you, I think, a sense of how much the ground has shifted out in the region. I think I'm really sort of agnostic about the question of Kurdish independence. The Kurds are the largest nation without a state in the region. There are 25 million Kurds in Syria, Turkey, and Iran. They don't have their own state. It's something of an anomaly. I think objections to Kurdish statehood in the past have always been prudential because Kurds are landlocked, and there's always the question of what it would portend for, you know, other nations. But I think you're seeing very interesting shift on the part of the Turks, who have traditionally been one of the strongest opponents of Kurdish independence. Today, they're one of the largest patrons of the Kurdistan regional government, with very large trade and very large investment on the order of, $8 billion worth of investment and $12 billion worth of trade, I think.
This is interesting because we've seen, among others, the spokesman for the AKP party in Turkey, Ambassador Eric Edelman, actually making noises sounding as though they would be indifferent to whether there were, in fact, an independent Kurdish state carved out of northern Iraq. This is a sea change, obviously. What might it mean? You say you're agnostic on the question, but I know you have expressed at the national interest some unease about what it might portend in terms of the response, if not from Turkey, certainly from Iran, or maybe the Syrians, also with large Kurdish populations.
Right. Well, I think, you know, one of the things we all have to be mindful of is that in my view, the post-Versailles, post-Ottoman Empire dispensation in the Middle East that was largely created by European colonial powers is now up for grabs. And I think what prudence dictates is we ought to be looking at what will ultimately lead to the most stable arrangements without a lot of revanchist claims that will just fuel, fighting and violence, for a long period of time. It may be that there's no arrangement that can do that, but we ought to be at least seeing if there's one that can. Therefore, I think the Kurds are going to be actually in the Kurdistan Regional Government they're likely to be quite careful in how they move. I think what you'll see in the first instance is what you're seeing now, which is trying to get the best possible deal and arrangements they can from the government in Baghdad, as long as there is one in Baghdad. But it's not completely clear that we're not going to see a complete fragmentation of the Iraqi state, given the disastrous consequences of the decision I mentioned earlier that President Obama made in 2011.
Yeah. Let me turn to Turkey itself, Ambassador Eric Edelman. You served there at a challenging time, to be sure, but it kind of looks like the good old days compared to what Turkey under Tayyip Erdogan has become. What do you make at the moment of Turkey's role in the region? Talk a little bit about Syria, if you would. It's sort of sanctions busting with respect to Iran, support for the likes of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, now evidently very much on the march, redesigning, as you say, some of the old Sykes-Picot colonial lines in the Middle East. Is it a reliable ally for this country, in your judgment?
Well, I think Turkey sort of ceased to be a reliable NATO ally some time ago, largely when it started to adopt a more sectarian political agenda, in part in response to what has been going on more broadly in the region. I think it's driven largely by what's happening domestically in Turkey, which is that Turkey is becoming much more authoritarian and much more a sort of a personalistic one-man regime. We'll see whether that can withstand the deep divisions that exist in Turkish society after the presidential election later this summer in August, which will be the first election by a popular vote in Turkey's history, modern history, but we will see whether Prime Minister Erdogan, who gives every indication he's going to be a candidate, will emerge from that with his mandate enhanced, or whether he may beat a political reverse. One of the questions is going to be, given the deep divisions in Turkish society, one of the speculations, I should say, is that he will require Kurdish votes in order to get elected president. So some of what you may be seeing in terms of statements from AKP spokespeople may have to do with the Turkish presidential election as much as anything else.
Maybe a little bit of a cynical bit of realpolitik to get his presidency established, but I don't think it will go well with the Kurds, or for that matter, U.S. interests if he should succeed. We'll be following it closely, as I know will you. Ambassador Eric Edelman, thank you for your past service to our country and that you're continuing to provide at the Center for Budgetary and Strategic Analysis. It's deeply appreciated, and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Representative Mark Meadows about ISIS, Hezbollah, Hamas, and right after this.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Hey, Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, the Presbyterian Church USA's biannual General Assembly considered two resolutions aimed at delegitimating and otherwise harming Israel. The Assembly actually narrowly approved one resolution calling for the divestment by the Church of three companies held in its portfolios. The reason? They do business with the Jewish state. Another resolution was even more problematic. Had it not been rejected, Presbyterians would have agreed that God's biblical blessings of the Jewish people applied only to their ancient state, not the modern one. Those hostile to Israel will continue trying to turn Presbyterians and others against her. We must stand with Israel. That means neither Americans of faith nor our government should, by resolutions, funding, or similar acts of Islamist appeasement, engage in measures that would isolate and perhaps ultimately destroy her. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Effney.
We're back. We're joined by Representative Mark Meadows. He represents with distinction the people of the 11th District of North Carolina. He is a freshman congressman, but has already made his mark in a number of respects, and we'll be talking about some of them momentarily. He serves on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, including its subcommittee on the Middle East and North Africa, an area of the world very much in our crosshairs at the moment, and that of a lot of other people, it turns out. Also is on the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and a member of the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, and a great friend of this program. We're delighted to have him back. Welcome, sir. It's good to have you again.
It is so good to be back with you, and thanks for always being a voice of truth.
Let's start, if we could, Congressman, just get your take on developments in Iraq, in the Middle East in large. There's a lot of ferment, but it seems to be reaching a boiling point in Iraq with ISIS's emergence and Kerry's trip to Baghdad and calls for the Maliki government to fall and be replaced by more sort of non-sectarian group. Where are we at the moment, do you think? And should we be aligning ourselves with Iran to try to combat ISIS?
I'm one of the ones that do not believe that we need to be aligning with Iran. When we can't even get an agreement in terms of getting rid of centrifuges, when they continue to hold Saeed Abedini, and now all of a sudden they're going to be our ally and intervening in Iraq. I can't imagine under what scenario that is prudent or even a good strategy. And so it is a mess. It is really one of those foreign policy, if you leave it alone, it'll fix itself kind of strategies. And we see the mess that we get with this administration on that kind of foreign policy. And yet we somehow think that we can come in and be friends to people who have been our enemies for such a long time and expect a different result. So I'm troubled by it. I don't see anything to really be gained of Secretary Kerry's trip to Baghdad, especially when we limit our options on the front end.
Congressman Mark Meadows, you have been very concerned about not only Iran, of course, and its nuclear program, but also its ties to the terrorist organization Hezbollah. You've just introduced this session some important legislation that it looks as though has broad bipartisan support. I'd love to have you talk a little bit about the Hezbollah International Financing Prevention Act, H.R. 4411, and where you think it's headed.
As you mentioned, Iran and Hezbollah have had a connection for many, many years, and yet we see Hezbollah being an arm that reaches into our hemisphere, Canada, Latin America, money laundering, drug trafficking.
Here in the United States as well.
Yes. I mean, so it's all over. And so this particular piece of legislation is really designed to go at the very heart of that, to go at the central banks, make sure that we put sanctions on them, and once and for all, cut off that pipeline of financial support that they have. We're real excited that we have topped over 300 co-sponsors. It's being marked up this Thursday. We expect to vote in the House in the very near future. And once and for all, trying to use one more tool in our tool bag to make sure that Hezbollah is not financing terrorists.
You have a counterpart piece of legislation, I understand it, in the Senate. Do you think its prospects are equally strong?
They are. Really, the Senate version took our language. We'd been working on ours for more than 12 months. They took most of our language, added a few things, a few reporting things that we will add in committee this week. And so you'll see a mirrored image in the Senate. And I'm very optimistic that it will move through. We've talked with the administration. And you know, the question is really simple. Either you're for terrorists or you're against them. It's a pretty simple question. And so most of us can agree, even in a bipartisan fashion, to be against terrorism. So I'm hopeful that it actually becomes law.
You know, I recall, if I'm not mistaken, John Brennan, then the Homeland Security Advisor to the President, now, of course, the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, talking at one point about there being sort of moderate elements in Hezbollah that we could work with. I hope you've disabused the administration of that and that they will, in fact, sign this into law. Congressman Mark Meadows, let me switch gears, if I may. Yet another problem in your portfolio, of course, is the unity government that has now been struck between Fatah and Hamas, another designated terrorist organization, also, by the way, supported at least in the past by Iran, in the aftermath of the kidnapping, apparently by Hamas, of three Israeli teenagers, including an American citizen. There has been a very concerted effort by the Israelis to find them, and this has seemingly been used by Hamas and others to foster a new, what some are calling, intifada. What do you make of the prospects here? Should the United States government be supporting a government that has Hamas in it? And do you think that we're likely to see this intifada rocket together with the ISIS developments and Jordan under threat and so on into a new regional conflict?
Well, I think the potential for regional conflict is very strong. And again, it gets back to what we were talking about with Iraq, is when you have terrorist groups are involved, they operate by a different standard. And to really see the Palestinian Authority join hands with Hamas, we came out very strong immediately against that. We've called for a termination of the funding to the Palestinian Authority. We also see that they are ramping up these activities, not only the three boys, and we've been very, very vocal about that, because that's activity in the West Bank. We're used to activity in Gaza, but this is now getting much, much closer to Jerusalem. And we've got to take a very strong, we can't take a wait and see. These are not fine wines. They don't improve with time. We've got to really start to work hard. I know there are a number of us. I've talked to the Appropriations Committee. We've talked to State Department officials about making sure that we let them know that the funds will dry up unless they continue, unless they disavow their tie with Hamas.
Good. Well, I hope you'll make that stick, both on the Hill and with the executive branch. Congressman, let me switch gears on two different subjects, both of them out of area there. But you also serve on the subcommittee on Africa, and I understand you've had a breakthrough just today on a case that has really commanded a lot of attention, and rightly so, in Sudan. Tell us what the latest is.
And you're really the first person that we're talking to. I've just received within the last hour a call from the ambassador of Sudan with Miriam Ibrahim, who is the Christian who would not disavow her faith, had a baby actually in prison. And the Sudan ambassador said that the courts this morning overturned the verdict and that she is going to be released. So my thanks to him for intervening on the part of the rule of law and justice. We've had ongoing dialogue for the last couple of weeks, and I'm just very excited to report the good news and look forward to her safe return here to the United States.
Well, I hope that will happen with her family. It's just been a horrific story for many weeks now, and this is a wonderful ending if indeed they are allowed to come here safely. And lastly, Congressman, you have on your website a marvelous quip about the preposterous development of all of the email correspondence involving Lois Lerner of IRS scandal fame. Talk a little bit about the spectacle of her missing emails and your finding about what Americans might say in response.
Well, the American people do not believe that in this day and age that emails, especially as critical and as high level that she is, just go missing. And we'll actually have another hearing today on Capitol Hill as well as tomorrow to continue to address this. But the story keeps changing. You know, at first they were giving us everything. We had everything. Then all of a sudden we didn't have everything. Then the computer crashed. There is a policy within the IRS that says that you have to actually print out emails and attach them to the file to save them. So I'm wanting, we're going to ask tonight, where are those printed emails that would support this? But it's nobody believes it, and it just really undermines credibility of the IRS, especially when it comes to it. they would not allow that with us if we were having an audit. So anybody that's listening, as I said, make sure that you said you sent your stuff to Lois Lerner between 2009 and 2011.
It's a great line. Congressman Roark Meadows, we have to let you go. Thank you for the oversight you're providing on all of these issues and for your leadership on so many of them. Keep it up. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Gordon Chang joins us next with a stocktaking on what's happening in Asia right after this.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday morning from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At America'sMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families,
including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's time for our visit with Gordon Chang as he takes us into the far reaches of the Far East to discuss matters of great importance, not only to the region, but to us as well. Gordon, of course, is our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio on the region and that of Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, and Fox News. He is the author of two terrific books on the region, one, The Coming Collapse of China, and North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it's always great to have you with us. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
You have written at Forbes about a chilling prospect, and that is that an ambitious program of not nuclear force modernization, but nuclear power production and sales export from China may create the next Chernobyls. Why do you say that, and how likely is it that we will see, in fact, either in China or elsewhere around the world, nuclear catastrophes as a result of the Chinese nuclear program?
Well, Beijing has the most ambitious nuclear generation program at home. It's building 28 of the world's 72 reactors, and it's got a lot more on the drawing board. But what China wants to do is to take untested designs, designs that it's not building in its own country, and export them elsewhere. And the first export customer is Pakistan. And by the way, Frank, the exports to Pakistan are in violation of Beijing's obligations as a member of the nuclear suppliers group. China believes that its exports to Pakistan are grandfathered, but nobody else believes that. And so what we have here is not only the export of perhaps dangerous designs, but also a proliferation risk.
This is, of course, consistent, as you know so well, Gordon Chang, with China's general attitude that agreements bind everybody else but them. So this is not exactly a surprise, but this untested design being sent overseas, this is not to be confused with the nuclear designs that the Europeans have given the Chinese that they're now building in their own country. There are some concerns about that one as well. Is that right, Gordon?
Yes. The European pressurized reactor, which was developed by Avaria, is certainly very interesting because these EPR reactors are going to be twice the size of the average reactor in the world, and China is building the first two of them. And clearly here there's a problem because Chinese regulators have now cut off the French regulators who were helping to oversee the project in Taishan, which is a coastal city in Guangdong province about 80 miles away from Hong Kong. And clearly there's a problem. We don't know what the problem is with Taishan, but when the Chinese stop talking to the French, we know that there's an issue. And the only question is, what is that issue?
Gordon, you've had a lot of close encounters with the Chinese over the years, and I know it won't come as a surprise to you, but it might to the rest of us, the kind of corners that the Chinese have routinely cut that has given rise to all kinds of safety issues with respect to high-rise buildings and dams and the like. Is it not overreaching to suggest that perhaps why the Chinese are behaving as they are towards the French regulators is that they've got a construction problem with one or more of these designs? And what might that portend if, in fact, they nonetheless proceed and bring this reactor online? For example, perhaps the people of Hong Kong.
Well, China is notorious for projects that don't work. They come in ahead of schedule and fall apart, literally. These two EPR reactors are about 4 years behind schedule in France and Finland, where two other projects are being built. The one in Hong Kong, one in Taishan is also behind schedule, but by much less. So there has really been a rush to get these two online quickly. And the ones in China are going to be the first ones in operation. Now, this is a European design, but the problem is if the Chinese are not talking to the Europeans about this, then, of course, there are going to be concerns. You know, China has not had a major accident in 22 years of operation of nuclear generation plants, but we don't know about the minor incidents that might have occurred, largely because the Chinese have not been talking about their civilian program in the way that other countries talk about theirs. So if there has been a problem, we don't know about it. And this is going to be the issue, because nuclear power stations are inherently difficult to design and to build and to operate. And the Chinese look like they're going to do this on their own. And now the Chinese want to export designs which are completely untested. And so, of course, there's going to be problems. You know, they want to sell them to Turkey, Argentina, Brazil, England. This is going to be a real issue for not just China and the people in Hong Kong nearby, but it's going to be an issue for everybody.
Yeah. And unfortunately, as we've discovered from Fukushima, the consequences of failures in the nuclear power industry can transcend borders as well. It's not just a problem for the people most immediately involved. Gordon, speaking of Hong Kong, you've written recently about what China is up to with respect to, well, it seems, redefining, I think is the term you've used, the autonomy arrangements that the British put in place when they surrendered Hong Kong to the Chinese in 1997. I was there on the occasion. It was a very dark day for freedom as far as I was concerned, but it sounds as though darker days are ahead. Talk a little bit about what the Chinese are up to in this heretofore autonomous region.
On July 1st, 1997, when the British surrendered Hong Kong to the People's Republic, Beijing had promised a high degree of autonomy for 50 years, and this was memorialized in the Joint British Declaration. Well, about 10 days ago, Beijing issued a white paper on Hong Kong, the first that it's issued since the handover. And basically, Beijing took back all the autonomy that it had promised in the Sino-British Joint Declaration. And what is interesting is that the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong had been flagging a little bit, but in the last week or so, it's been re-energized because of what Beijing has been doing. And there has been a referendum, which has attracted now about 750,000 or so people in Hong Kong voting on various proposals for the election of chief executive, which is the top political officer, which is scheduled to occur in 2017. And people in Hong Kong have been talking about the process for this, and Beijing has been trying to restrict that process. So clearly what we have is at least a short-term win for pro-democracy forces, as Beijing insists on shooting itself in the foot by basically creating the opposition against it. But the people in Hong Kong need support, because they've got still a very difficult battle with Beijing on the nominating process for the chief executive in the 2017 election.
As a practical matter, though, if you were a betting man, Gordon Chang, I assume that you would be putting your money on the Chinese rather than on the Hong Kong people, because while they've shown a lot of pluck, they unfortunately find themselves increasingly, I suspect, under the thumb of the authorities in Hong Kong that owe their allegiance first and foremost to Beijing, not to those people.
Yeah, Beijing holds most of the cards in this, but nonetheless, what has occurred over the last 3 or 4 years is a real sentiment in Hong Kong against China. And this is also mirrored by what we've been seeing in Taiwan. So, you know, as Ronald Reagan has said, the forces of freedom are really quite powerful, and we're starting to see them in Hong Kong. I agree with you, Frank. Beijing has a lot of ability to shape this in directions we don't want it to go. But, you know, people are fighting and they're resisting, and this is a very, very good development.
Well, and they deserve our support. I think that's your key point, Gordon, and I hope that they will be getting it. Gordon, very quickly, talk a little bit about your new paper on the possibility that Modi's India may outperform China.
Well, right now, China's economy is stumbling. It's not growing at the 7.4% that they claim for the first quarter of this year. It's really in the low single digits, though the recent stimulus program has helped a little bit. But the point is that in India, you have a new prime minister who's very pro-business, who is very, very meticulous, who is determined. And so we're going to see, I think, the Indian economy start to rev up again. And it's going to be growing at much faster pace than the Chinese one. And that's good news for the world, and especially the free world.
Well, let's hope so and keep rooting for the free world. And that most especially, as we were just talking about, that we don't see some of it surrendered further to communist China at a moment when it is clearly on the march. Gordon Chang, as always, we appreciate your time and expertise tremendously. Thank you for the great work you do at Fox and Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com, as well as our weekly visits. Keep it up, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From from the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.